The biggest thing I'm telling parents is that rates of in-school transmission can remain low if mitigation measures are in place. And that is what we have. We have upgraded air filtration systems, we've increased our custodial staff, we have a robust testing program, and our required masking of all students and staff that enter this campus.
LAUSD Medical Director Smitha Malhotra last week as the district gets ready to welcome kids back to school later this month. In addition to mandatory masks and social distancing, LAUSD says it will require weekly testing for students, teachers, and employees, regardless of vaccination status. And as an added safety measure against the Delta variant, which is surging right now in LA County, parents will also have until the end of this week to decide whether to send their kids back to school or continue with distance learning. Joining us with a look at the start of the school year is Howard Bloom. He's an education reporter at the LA Times. Hi, Howard.
Hi.
Well, testing for those kids who are heading back to school actually started today. So what is the ramp up to reopening on August 16th look like?
It looks like if you want to get back to in-person education, you're going to have to get a baseline coronavirus test. And for many students, they are used to this already because some of them, fewer than a third came back starting in April. And then maybe 1 in 8 came in over the summer. So this will be familiar to many, but actually for most students, I guess it'll be a new experience. And the district also will have never tested at this volume before, but they've had a whole year to get ready for it. And they tell us they're ready. So that's one of the big things is getting tested and getting ready. And of course, everybody's terrified over the new variant, just to make things a little more complicated.
Yeah. So will volume be the big difference between how things look like now versus how they looked like at the end of the last school year?
Well, if we take the word volume in an expansive way, it's not just the volume of testing, but the volume of students on campus, because the default option here is that students will be back on a normal schedule full time 5 days a week. And there is no social distancing requirement in California anymore in terms of schools. What they say is separate the students as much as possible, but that they don't want any student not to be able to go back because of social distancing requirements. And so, that's going to look different in different places.
So what is this going to look like? I mean, what is the structures to set up testing all staff and students once a week, every week?
Well, they're spending a lot of money on it. I mean, last year, and as you recall, last year schools were closed, or campuses at least were closed most of the year. LA Unified still spent, by its own estimate, $120 million on its coronavirus testing program. And now school is actually in session and they're proposing to test everybody. They have contractors in place. They have a testing, a company that will actually fly the test to a lab in Northern or around the Bay Area. I think they're doing most of the analysis. They're doing this testing. They get the results in ideally by the next morning. There's going to be mobile testing vans going from school to school. And it's going to be quite a logistics operation, but in some form or another, it's happening at all school districts. I don't think that all school districts, well, I know all school districts are not planning to test everybody. And in some instances, they're testing only the unvaccinated, or they're doing kind of randomized screening tests, maybe testing 1 out of 10, 1 out of 5, 1 out of 3, whatever they can manage. But LA Unified, as far as I know, is doing the most comprehensive testing that I'm aware of.
But given that, and given how quick we know that this disease can spread, I mean, simply testing everyone once a week, I mean, that would seem to leave a lot of opportunity for this disease to spread and cause outbreaks. I mean, you could test positive on a Monday and then catch it later in the week, even later in the day, that potentially wouldn't be detected. So why has the district decided on this once a week kind of goalpost?
I think it's logistics partly. And I think they could argue that what they're doing is much more than most places are doing. And they would also argue that there are many tiers of safety here. So testing, coronavirus testing, and actually the goal, what you want to get is a negative test. If you get a positive test, that's what you don't want in this case. Positive is bad, even though positive is good in many aspects of life. So you have masks. Everybody's wearing masks. In LA Unified, they're making people wear masks outdoors as well. A lot of other districts are not doing that. And there are certain districts that are not enforcing mask requirements at all in other parts of the state. The state, by the way, requires masks, but there are certain school districts that have said, well, unless you send your sheriff to enforce them, we're not going to make students wear a mask. In LA Unified, you wear a mask indoors and outdoors. The outdoors part is controversial because people say it's not important, but you have these other layers of safety. You have improved ventilation, for example. You have as much social distancing as you can manage, and you have frequent cleaning, although there's a lot of debate about whether all this cleaning is actually a waste of time, because that's not how the disease spreads anyway. But it's like that. It's sort of like the Swiss cheese model. If you have one piece of Swiss cheese, you see a huge holes in it, right? But if you put more pieces of Swiss cheese, soon there aren't any holes visible. And if that were a virus going through that Swiss cheese, maybe you've prevented that virus from getting through.
So really quickly, we've only got about 30 seconds here, but what's the mood among parents? I mean, they have until the end of the week to decide whether to opt out of in-person learning. How are parents feeling?
I think they range from terrified and uncertain about what to do to feeling that, oh, what a bother. Kids are going to be safe and this testing is a real pain. It runs the spectrum.
Howard Bloom, education reporter for the LA Times. Thank you, Howard.
Happy to do it.
Coming up, the Legal Eagle, Jessica Levinson, breaks down HIPAA, the landmark health privacy law, and why it won't stop your employer from asking whether you've been vaccinated. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Michelle Alloy, in for Madeline Brand. During a recent push from some House Republicans to encourage their supporters to get vaccinated, a reporter asked a pair of questions to one of the party's rising stars, Georgia Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Two questions. Have you yourself gotten vaccinated, and do you disagree with the Republican whip?
Well, your first question is a violation of my HIPAA rights. You see, with HIPAA rights, we don't have to reveal our medical records, and that also involves our vaccine records.
Well, not quite. That's actually not at all how HIPAA works. But because this landmark privacy law is quickly approaching meme status, we're going to talk about what HIPAA is, what it isn't, and how it's being used as a political prop. And since it's Monday, Jessica Levinson is here with us, Loyola Law School professor and our regular Legal Eagle. Hello.
Michelle, hello.
Well, it's great to have you. So first off, give us a quick primer on HIPAA, or formally the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act.
Rolls off the tongue. It's
know,
really strange just... that we have an acronym for it. So it is a 1996 law. It's a Clinton era law, and it's in part designed to protect our privacy regarding some of our health related information. But it does not at all cover what Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene talks about. It prevents health plans, healthcare clearinghouses, and basically other healthcare providers from revealing your medical information.
So, okay, let's break down then a little bit what she said. That first question, not a violation of her HIPAA rights to ask her whether or not she's been vaccinated.
Not only not a violation of her HIPAA rights, but let's think about whether or not she could possibly be correct. If she's right, that means members of the press cannot ask sitting members of Congress about their health or about health-related information. Now, there's another violation here we should be thinking about, and that's a First Amendment violation. We simply don't have a system of laws in our country where we say to the press, you're not allowed to ask these questions. Again, she can say, I'm not answering, but it's in no way a violation of HIPAA for the question to be asked. And it likely would be a violation of the First Amendment if you weren't allowed to ask.
So what rights do we have under HIPAA?
The rights that we have are basically the rights of telling healthcare providers, our insurance companies, not to provide our confidential or medical information to others. But it doesn't prevent us from saying anything. It's really about the people who provide us with our healthcare and ensuring that they're not going to go tell our employers or our friends, oh, did you know that Jessica has, you know, X, Y, and Z? This explains so much.
So what about employers, though? Does HIPAA prevent them from asking for our health information? Because this is going to be a huge issue as we move forward into the realm of vaccine mandates. I mean, already you've seen Disney and other companies saying that they want to either mandate proof of vaccine or subject employees to regular testing.
Huge issue. And no, it does not. In fact, our employers can ask us a whole host of health-related questions. The real issue here is that if you say, I'm not vaccinated, then employers can dip their toe into some legally questionable waters if they say, well, why not? Because then you could potentially get into, if somebody says, well, I have a good faith religious belief, or I have a disability. Employers can push too far if they ask why. But let's for a minute think about all of the situations where employers absolutely can ask us about our health. Think about the airline pilot. The airline company has to make sure that she has good vision. There's a whole host of information that employers can say, we'd like to know. And, you know, to get to your question, absolutely, employers have been, will, and can ask about vaccine status. Now, you don't have to answer, but then your employers can treat you as if you're not vaccinated and basically put you in a different bucket to protect the rest of us.
All right, well, let's switch to another news story. On Friday, the Justice Department issued a legal opinion on former President Trump's tax returns. The DOJ says the Treasury Department has to turn over 6 years of Trump's tax returns to the House. It's a huge win for Democrats. They've been pushing for years to get their hands on these financial records. But Trump has shown over and over that he'll use really every legal option available to him to keep this information private. So let's start with that Department of Justice opinion. What did it say?
It basically said Congress has a valid reason to ask for this information, that Congress is not, in fact, on a partisan fishing expedition. And Congress said, we'd like this information because we're looking into conflicts of interest. We're looking into enforcement of the tax code. Nancy Pelosi recently said we're looking at national security issues, again, related to the conflicts of interest. So the Department of Justice is saying, yeah, Congress, you get to ask. And under federal law, you don't only get to ask, but you get to obtain that information. So that's how the Department of Justice really has changed course.
And yeah, this is a reversal from what the Department of Justice's policy was under previous Attorney General Bill Barr.
It is. So previous Secretary of Treasury Mnuchin said, I'm not giving this information. Attorney General Barr said, we're not providing this information. Former President Trump fought, as we said, tooth and nail. He fought Congress. He fought investigators in New York. He fought basically anybody who wanted this information. And now, after a very lengthy battle, the Department of Justice has said, in fact, we looked at the law and you do have to hand over this information. The only question is when, because Trump does get to contest this.
So, and right. And he has until, I guess, tomorrow to say whether or not he wants to contest this. What would his likely legal arguments be?
Yeah, I don't think he has a ton of legal arguments. I think he's going to be recycling what we've seen before, which is they're just asking because they're on a quote unquote partisan witch hunt to try and punish him, and that this is just about targeting him. It's not for any valid legislative purpose. That's going to be the magic words that we see. But that's been a losing argument. He lost against the New York investigators. The Supreme Court basically said, yep, give that information over. And I expect that a judge will say the same thing with respect to these congressional requests.
What are the potential larger implications, though, of this decision and how it could affect future presidents and whether or not they want to turn over their tax returns?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think the future implications are Exactly right. Look at a different Congress, a different president. What the Department of Justice is saying here is they're setting precedent to indicate that at least in similar circumstances, Congress does have the ability to say there are three leaders of Congress and under federal law, they're entitled to obtain the information for any taxpayer, including the president. He is any taxpayer. And so this wouldn't just be for President Trump. It would be for future presidents as well. Now, of course, we don't typically get into this situation for other presidents because they voluntarily provide that information.
And so what's the likelihood that we, the public, get to see these records?
Well, knowing Congress and how it tends to kind of leak like a sieve at times, I think that it is more likely than not that we will get a fuller picture of these tax returns fairly soon. How much and when is probably the big question.
Jessica Levinson, Loyola Law School professor and our regular Legal Eagle. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, the pandemic forced a lot of restaurants to ditch their physical menus and ask their customers to use QR codes. But privacy experts say those little black boxes can leave your data vulnerable.
You can hack or have a fake QR code, and then people are just putting in their contact information, even their payment information. So that's definitely something that experts are concerned about.
The downsides of QR codes. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Michelle Alloy, in for Madeline Brand. If you've been to a restaurant recently, instead of being handed a physical menu, you may have been asked to use a QR code. It's a black and white square you scan with your phone, and it gives you a link to the restaurant's menu, so you can browse food options, even order your meal without ever interacting with a server. And this way of dining may be here to stay. That's because a lot of data can be collected from people using those QR codes, like which dishes sell best, a customer's order history, even their credit card information. Here to talk about this is Erin Wu, technology reporter for the New York Times. Hi, Erin.
Hi.
So I think most of us have probably used a QR code at some point in our lives, but we may not know exactly how this technology works. So explain that for us.
Right. So a QR code is essentially a kind of barcode. It's this pixelated black and white square. And so in order to use it, you basically just point your phone camera at it. It'll automatically take some kind of action. So most of the time that is opening up a URL or an app, but it can also send an email, send a text, connect to Wi-Fi, things like that. So it's at this point really easy for the consumer because Apple added integration inside of the native camera apps. You really just point and then it'll take you somewhere.
And this really took off, at least as it relates to bar and restaurants during the pandemic, because it cut down the amount of time that servers had to interact with people at a time when human interaction, we wanted to keep that to a minimum, right?
Yeah, there are a couple other factors as well. So the CDC guidance during the pandemic said that restaurants either had to use disposable menus or disinfect the menus between each use. Obviously, that is a lot of either waste or extra work for the restaurants. And they were also dealing with really changing supply chains. And so what they would be able to actually serve would vary day by day. And so rather than having to reprint the menu every time, having a QR code menu made it a lot easier to just insert or delete a line.
And as you report, now that, I mean, things are tepidly sort of returning to a quasi-normal, this technology might be here to stay, though, because the restaurants are seeing a big benefit from it, right? They can collect data from the people who are using these QR codes. What kind of data?
Right. So it kind of depends on what service they're using. So different services do it different ways. I spoke with one startup, Mr. Yum, which is helping restaurants build kind of order histories of their customers so they get access to what customers have ordered in the past. And Mr. Yum is working on a pilot right now that could eventually lead to a kind of recommended for you section, so personalized menus and experiences like we already see in e-commerce.
And so what are the potential downsides of this from a customer's perspective? Do most people realize that this information is being collected about them?
Yeah, so I didn't speak to every customer. Obviously, I don't want to speak for customers as to what they do or don't know, but I spoke with a lot of privacy experts who are saying that really what QR codes are doing is they're introducing an online element into what was previously an offline experience. So when you're just going to a restaurant, you see a paper menu, you order, you pay, all of that happens without any introduction of the internet or any kind of online advertising or tracking. But as Jay Stanley from the ACLU puts it, when you use a QR code, it inserts the entire apparatus of online tracking between you and your meal. So it opens up all of these different possibilities for things like tracking and targeting and advertising.
And so what kind of data is being collected? I mean, we talked about order histories, but what else?
Yeah, so order histories, customer, oftentimes contact information, so customer's phone number, their payment information, their email address. Some companies and some restaurants are using this as a way to build an email list for marketing. So they now have like 15,000 customer emails. So every time they are doing an event or some like a special or something like that, they can just blast that out to their marketing list in a way that they never would have been able to before.
And do we know how that information is being stored? What do privacy experts say about that?
Right. So oftentimes what happens is once you have clicked into the once you have scanned the QR code and you're going into the digital menu system, at that point, for example, Mr. Yum's system uses cookies in order to store your order history and things like that. And so once you have entered your phone number to check out for the first time, then it starts building an order history. So it's working in much the same way that online e-commerce sites use tracking.
And ultimately, these squares, it's just a piece of paper, black and white code. Somebody who's technologically savvy could probably replicate something, create their own QR code that they could then tie to something that they could be able to hack your information or collect data that you don't necessarily know that you're giving over to somebody that isn't what you think you're scanning. So how realistic is that scenario?
I mean, honestly, that's another thing that the privacy experts I was talking with were really concerned about. So it's in some ways even easier to just paste a dummy QR code over where you think you're actually scanning, whether or not that's like on a flyer on the side of the street or whether that's in a restaurant situation. And so, I mean, I think just for consumers, it's really important to make sure that you know what you are scanning, you know where that's coming from, because that is definitely a possibility that you can hack or have a fake QR code and then people are just putting in their contact information, even their payment information. So that's definitely something that experts are concerned about.
You went to a bar in San Francisco called Teeth and you spoke with the owner there. What was his experience using these QR codes?
Yeah, so I went to Teeth, which is a bar in San Francisco's Mission neighborhood, and I was talking with Ben Lyman, the owner of Teeth, and he really, really loves QR codes. One of the biggest benefits for him is that it lets him cut down on labor costs. So because he has these QR codes that are handling ordering and payment, that's less that his servers have to do. So he was saying that it really helps him as he's trying to ramp up service again, because it's so difficult for restaurants and bars to hire employees right now.
Well, how did the servers feel about that? Because we have been hearing about these big labor shortages, particularly in the restaurant industry. It's been hard to hire people, but I imagine that the folks who are there probably sort of see their jobs potentially being replaced by automation.
Right. So I spoke with a manager at Teeth and he really likes it. But I also spoke with a customer at Teeth who's a server at a different bar in San Francisco's Mission neighborhood, and he's really concerned about it. So his bar isn't using the QR codes yet, but he says that while it's convenient for him as a customer, he's worried that it'll put him out of his job or it'll mean cutting down on his hours or his co-workers' hours if the bar implements it. So he was saying that like people depend on those 40 hours. So when bar owners and restaurant owners are talking about the labor costs they're saving, that also has really real impacts for the people who depend on that money.
Well, right, and especially in expensive cities like San Francisco, Los Angeles, yes. New York. But it's also not just restaurants that are adopting this technology, right? I mean, CVS and Foot Locker, you report, are also doing this.
Yeah, so this is something that's happening at retailers as well. So PayPal introduced QR code technology, so did Square, and it's happening at retailers like CVS, Foot Locker, Nike, and about a million small businesses. So this is something that's taking off really everywhere from like small farmers market stores to big retailers.
And it seems likely to stick around, at least for the time being.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, Erin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
That's Erin Wu. She covers technology for the New York Times. Well, whether you're browsing a restaurant menu on your phone or the old-fashioned way, you might notice the seafood section looks a bit slim these days. Restaurants across the country are pulling dishes like crab croquettes and seared sea scallops off their menus because the prices are just too high right now, thanks to a major delay in the supply chain. Just as consumers' demand for a nice seafood dinner is soaring. Here to talk about this is Kate Crater, food editor for Bloomberg News. Welcome to Press Play.
Hi, nice to talk to you.
Well, great to have you. So you write that seafood prices overall have gone up about 11% in the past year, but certain items, it's even higher. But give us an example of what restaurants are seeing.
Yeah, no, it's gotten really bad. Restaurants, I think, thought that as the pandemic seemed to be easing, you know, they were finally going to be able to reap the benefits and, you know, people were going to be able to, you know, serve customers and finally be on the other side of it. And now there's so many constraints. I mean, everyone's heard about the staffing shortages, but the supply chain is really tight right now, especially for seafood. And so a pound of halibut, before the pandemic, it might've gone for $16. Now it's 28. The worst example that we're hearing is about scallops. Scallops are getting pulled from menus across the country. They've gone up to about $42 a pound. Chefs were buying them for about $28 pre-pandemic. And then blue crab was $18 a pound before the pandemic. And now chefs report seeing it for as much as $44 a pound.
Wow. So, I mean, at least for the scallops and the halibut, that's near doubling for the crab.
Or more.
Yeah. So you mentioned that there's this big supply chain hang up. What is driving this?
It's a really good question. It's happening along a lot of legs of the journey, so to speak. Docks are definitely missing workers. And so everything from unpacking supplies to moving it along to getting it shipped. There's a lack of truck drivers. So even if the seafood does land on the dock and get processed, it's not always being transported. We've heard some instances where fishermen have begun selling directly to consumers. When they couldn't always sell to restaurants, they found a new market and consumers come and pick it up at the docks. And so now chefs are sometimes now having to go pick up their seafood at the docks. And that's one more thing they don't want to do. They're already working so hard. So it's coming on a lot of levels.
Well, right. The chefs are dealing with other issues, right? I mean,
right.
Restaurants, they have a staffing shortage there. They're having a hard time hiring people. Sometimes they've had to raise their wages in order to pay people more to get people to come back to work. So this is just sort of yet another cudgel that is really hurting their business.
It's kind of unbelievable how it just doesn't stop for chefs. And the other thing is, if you think about it, it's not so easy just to pull something off the menu. I mean, you can make a choice to do it, but it might be a customer favorite. Like you mentioned croquettas, crab croquettas. And that was something at a restaurant called Iberian Pig in Atlanta, Jose Pina. It was a favorite and he had to take them off because crab, he said it was insulting to have to try and pass along the heightened cost to customers, but they raised a stink. They were like, we love our crab croquettas. So it hurts all the way down the line.
Yeah. And so like, what is this translating to on menus? I mean, certainly you talked to a few chefs who've pulled the items, but in terms of cost increases for those who decide to keep them on, like what do those look like?
It's a really good question, Michelle. Some places are passing on costs. In Orlando, they've decided that maybe a $2 or $3 increase on an entree might be okay. But at this place called The Clam in New York City, the chef Mike Price, who had to take scallops off the menu, his entrees generally top off in the high 30s, and he does not see an appetite, no pun intended, but he is not able to offer entrees for over $40. And so he had to replace it with halibut. He was finding halibut at a decent price, but he has to price it under $40 to get customers to order it, you know, to see some love for the dish. And so he thought that was the kind of thing, you know, scallops are sort of a fancy entree and halibut might work in its place instead.
Well, and you also mentioned a restaurant, High Tide Harry's, that, you know, the problem wasn't necessarily that they weren't getting people into the door, that consumer demand, the number of customers that they were having, they were raking in a record profit, but the prices for seafood were so high that they actually ended in a net loss of something like $14,000.
Can you believe it? It really is. I mean, that just shows you how high ingredient prices are going. And you might have seen it in the supermarket, but for chefs who have to, you know, buy big volume and then to hope that customers will order it, we did hear also from some purveyors that they're seeing chefs go to safety ingredients like shrimp. They're not ordering something like there's something called blue spot prawns that are fancy and expensive, and you don't know what the demand's going to be on a given night. And so they've seen demand on that dip by at least 50%, purveyors have.
So in terms of what we're seeing in the seafood market, is this the same inflationary phenomenon that we've been seeing, you know, when it comes to used cars, when it comes to other things in the economy? I mean, it seems like as consumers are getting ready to get out there, even as Delta surges, there's still a massive supply issue pretty much everywhere you look.
Yeah, no, it's definitely across the board. You can't say that it's isolated with seafood or scallops. But I will say that, you know, the used car shortage has been big since during the pandemic when people wanted to take road trips. And this seems to be so much based on the fact that restaurants have been reopening and people are more comfortable, or have been before the Delta variant began spreading so much. People have been much more comfortable going out to eat. So the demand has just shot up in the past couple months. We did reach out to reporters in other countries in places like London and Singapore and Tokyo. They are not seeing an increase in price on seafood. In fact, in some places, the price is going down because a lot of the restaurants haven't reopened and there's just not the demand for it.
Well, so are there any signs when we might see a leveling out of this here in the United States?
It's an excellent question. It's the $5 billion question. I think that as workers, you know, I think that when there's more dock workers to help, you know, speed up the supply chain, that's going to help a lot. But there are some indicators that some of these prices might take a while to come back down. Fishermen, it turns out, is an aging industry. There are some studies that say most fishermen are over 40 and a lot of them left the business during the pandemic, and younger people aren't willing to go into it. So there might be some lasting effects on this.
Well, Kate, thank you so much for joining us today.
Michelle, so great to talk to you.
That's Kate Crater, food editor for Bloomberg News. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Michelle Aloy, in for Madeline Brand. Pop artist Prince sold more than 100 million records in his lifetime. So also an extremely prolific artist, recording dozens of studio albums, film soundtracks, and live performances. And that's just what was released to the public. When Prince died in 2016, he left behind thousands of unreleased recordings in what his estate calls the vault. In that trove was at least one entire album, an album that was just released on Friday. It's called Welcome to America.
Welcome to America.
Prince and his band recorded Welcome to America in 2010, but the album was ultimately shelved until now. Joining me to talk about it are two of Prince's former bandmates. First, we have Prince's longtime vocalist, Shelby J. Shelby, welcome to the program.
Hey, how's it going? Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. And also here we have Morris Hayes. He played keyboards in Prince's band, New Power Generation, and co-produced Welcome to America. Hi, Morris.
Hey, how you doing? Glad to be here too.
Well, it's good to have you both. So Shelby and Morris, what is it like to hear these songs over a decade later?
Wow, it's really like going back in time. It's beautiful. And it brings back so many wonderful memories of what we were doing during that time, recording it. And it's just great. I mean, it really is like going into a time capsule and getting to relive all of these special moments again, you know, and the music is just so funky.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. I you know, it's just incredible the amount of work and that we would do. I mean, you have to think about it. I mean, this was done in 2010. Prince also released an album called 2010 that he did in 2010. So it was a lot of music, and to have this come back up was amazing. You know, it just was an amazing thing, and so poignant even now. So I just think it's incredible that, like Shelby said earlier, she said, you know, it's music. You don't have an expiration date, you know.
Well, Shelby, let's start with you, because right after you recorded this album, you all went out on tour ostensibly to promote the album, but you didn't sing any of the songs.
Right.
What happened?
Well, I'm sorry, I had to just laugh because the tour was named Welcome to America.
Right.
But we didn't sing any of the songs. We did, actually, we did a little snippet of Welcome to America over a groove. I think it was Dreamer, over the groove of Dreamer. And then at one point, fans, they didn't know what we were singing, but he just wanted to do that. We did a little bit of that. But it was, you know, you learned, as being in Prince's band, I learned to go with the flow and trust wherever he was leading us at the time. So it was like, okay, we're on to the next. We knew this music was there, but it was like, okay, we're doing this now. And so we were so it's all encompassing when it's, you know, when you're preparing for a tour, you don't even have time to think about what you're not doing because you're doing so much. But yeah, you learn to just really trust him and expect the unexpected with Prince always.
Well, let's hear a little bit more from that title track, Welcome to America.
Yeah.
Keep playing. It gets worse.
Land of the free, home of the brave. Oops, I mean, land of the free, home of the slave.
Get down. Down.
Transformation happens deep within. Yes.
Knees.
Oh no.
So, Morris, a lot of these songs are directly commenting on issues of race, of corporate greed, that the whole album feels just eerily prescient for the times that we're finding ourselves in right now. So, what was Prince's mindset at that time?
Well, I remember when I came over, you know, when I got the call to come in, it wasn't anything unusual from the things that we had done before, you know, where he called me and he got some heat. He wanted me to hear, I got a little heat. I want you to hear this heat. And so I get over there and he's waiting in his car and I hop in with him. And then so he starts, you know, playing. He starts telling me about the project itself. As the tracks are playing, I'm listening. I'm going like, bro, like you're going hard on these lyrics right here. And he's like, yeah, you know, I really want to, you know, transfer this energy that he's feeling right now. And I was like sitting there, like the first three tracks were just like bam, 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 one behind the other. And I was just like, okay, this is definitely a departure from what normally he has done when it comes to what he was, you know, the music that we had done previously.
There's one line in the song, land of the free, home of the brave. Oops, I mean, land of the free, home of the slave. So how did Prince view activism as a musician? How did he incorporate that into his music?
Well, I think Prince always knew that we had a very powerful platform with music. It's historically, that has been the thing that has moved people and moved the masses is music. And nothing's changed at this point. I think when you have an artist the size of Prince, in terms of his reach and his popularity, I think he knew he needed to use that in order to affect change. and to be out here and call these issues out and just say, okay, this is what's happening. What are we going to do about it? You know what I mean? That's what he had to do.
No, that's real talk, because like, you know, like Morris was saying, you can't fix a problem if you don't acknowledge it. So you got to call it out, you know, and he would do it in his music. You know, he would call it out so people could pay attention.
And Shelby, you know, as somebody who had worked with him for a long time, were you also surprised at the sort of overt political overtones of the first couple songs?
Wow. At first, but I, you know, like I said, I learned with Prince, expect the unexpected. And he was always, you know, ahead of everyone as far as, you know, his music and his vision. And he could just kind of like see into the future. So I looked at the lyrics and I was like, wow, he's hitting on some heavy stuff here, like Son of a Slave Master. And he's really, you know, calling people to task. And he's talking about ownership and publishing and social injustice and wanting the hood to be safe and what he dreams and wanting every child to have an education and talking about immigration and borders. And I mean, he really went in, and I love that. When I looked at it, I was like, this is something else.
Well, let's listen to another song from the album. This is Same Page, Different Book. And Shelby, this is you rapping.
Let's take a listen.
Chapter, verse, which hangs first? Thinking too slow, why to snatch your purse? Faith, law, good deeds, practicing what you preach. Between you and me, TV ain't reality. That's right, I said it, it's said. Buy this, cop that, all up in your head. 24-hour news, that ain't right. Huh. Them suckers got your day dreaming at midnight.
Huh. So, Shelby, tell me about that moment, because had you rapped before? It seems like he just sort of spur of the moment asked you to do this.
Yeah, I had rapped on live shows, a few other songs. Like, we have a song, Beginning Endlessly, and I'd write something, he'd let me do it at one of our concerts, like at the Forum. But for this, he just kind of looks at me and he was like, I need a rap right here. You got something? I was like, give me a minute. And I ran out into the hallway right outside Studio A and sat down by this beautiful mural of all of the artists that inspired Prince throughout his whole lifetime. And that gave me inspiration. And I sat there and I wrote. He kept looking out the window, the door, going, you done? You done? I was like, not yet. I'm almost done. And so when he looked out and I was like, I'm done. And he was like, all right, get on the mic. And he didn't ask to see it or proofread it or anything, spell check it. And I got on the mic and did it. And he loved it and kept it. And, you know, I was like, yes. You know, he gave me like the thumbs up. It's like that approval, you know, from your big brother. Like, yeah, you did that. So yeah, I was really happy when I heard the whole record. I was like, yeah, I got bars, man. I got bars, Prince, I told you.
And that's so amazing, because I think a lot of people think of him as a control freak to some degree. And so for you to just kind of go off, like toss off a rap in a couple minutes, and that was that. I mean, that's incredible.
Yeah.
He was a control freak. I mean, he could be, but it was the trust that he had in Shelby and the rest of us, to like, even with the co-production, with myself, he was able to say, okay, you know, he is a micromanager and a taskmaster, but he still gives you that room to like give you your shot. And if you come through, then you're good to go. You know what I mean?
And I mean, I love this song. I mean, just because it sort of encapsulates both parts of him, right? Like, you've got the sort of social commentary, the conversation on the political divide that's really only grown in the last decade. But it's also really catchy and funky and fun.
Yeah, it is. It's like he can do that. He can give you those lessons and those nuggets, and you'll be dancing. And you'll, you know, as you're dancing and grooving, you're like, wait a minute, he just dropped some serious knowledge there. He's making me think about, you know, religion and humanity and how we're more alike than we are different. And like, yeah, but you're grooving at the same time, because the music is so funky. So yeah, he had a great gift for that.
It's just one of those amazing things with Prince, that he just had this uncanny ability to just get out of us and out of himself. Like he told me one time before, he said, it's very difficult to produce yourself, you know, because you don't push yourself a lot of times as hard as somebody else would. And so he just knew the right balance and what to do with us and, you know, with the music and all of these things. He was so, so good at it, and was just able to really just like keep everything different, yet, you know, keep everything moving. And so I really appreciate the, you know, all of the things that I've learned from him, just watching him do how he did his thing. And so it was just amazing.
Well, let's hear one more song from the album. This is Hot Summer.
Everybody's got a favorite friend. They got your back no matter what till the end. Ain't got no breaks, but got a whole lot of them. Every broken heart can mend. You better believe it.
So, Shelby, talk a little bit about this song. It's so catchy. You can just hear it on the radio. I mean, instantly. It just seems like an instant summer classic.
Yeah, it makes me want, I always say, it makes me want to be at the beach doing a twist, like in a beach movie. And like, we're all out there jamming, throwing beach balls around, like just having fun. And I remember when we finished doing this, we all got in the car and we acted with Prince and we went driving through the park in Minneapolis. Like, Elisa was like, they're going to see him. They're going to know it's him. And, you know, a few people would look and they're like, no, because they look twice. Like, I know that's not Prince, like driving through the park in the middle of the day, bobbing with three girls to some music, and we were playing it loud too. We were just jamming the hot summer. So I have that beautiful memory of that song. And just, you know, right now, coming out of, well, we're still in the pandemic, but we're on the other half of it, hopefully, people just really need something to make them have fun. And just to make them just, so many things have happened. People have lost people, people have lost jobs, people have had all kinds of bad things. And it's like, sometimes you just need something to make you feel good and happy and just dance around your house, you know, or dance around in your backyard. And this is one of those songs. It's just happy, you know?
Well, and looking back on Prince's legacy and him, who you knew so well, I mean, how this seems like sort of the duality of his personality, right? Like, we heard all of these sort of more serious political songs, but also, like, they're just fun jams. I mean, how do you remember him?
Wow. I just remember him as being a beautiful brother, very giving, but definitely complex. He could go deep. And then he could have a lot of fun and tell jokes that would have you, you know, bending over laughing, just gut laughing, you know, crying tears. So there was that duality of him being extremely educated. He has so many books on about so many different things. He's like, Shelby, you need to read this. You need to watch this. You need to learn this. So he cared about education and all that kind of stuff too. But at the same time, he'd want to have fun. He'd send me YouTube clips sometimes of people making fun of him, and we'd laugh together. I mean, you know, so you, it was just a beautiful, complex coexistence of the serious and the fun loving, you know, at the same time.
Yeah. And Morris, how about you?
Yeah. I mean, my thing is, halfway through my career, I figured out that there was five of them. And when I did that, I wish I had thought about it when I first started. It would have made my life with less gray hair. You know, I said it was five Princes. And you know, the first one being Purple Rain Prince. That's the one I went and saw in 84 and saw that movie. And I thought, that's who Prince is, because I'd never seen a movie where everybody in the movie is playing themselves. That was the first one. The second one was when I got in the band and saw, like, what a hard band leader, like a tough, this guy's like, you know, he was like rough. And the third guy was like Shelby, he's like, he's playing basketball. We're like, you know, goosing and running around through the studio, like, you know, like the Beatles reels where they're all running around, falling down. I mean, it was just like fun guy. And then it was like number four was like the sad Prince. He was like, there was something wrong and he was having a bad day. You're probably gonna have a bad day. And the number five was like what Shelby said earlier, just give you the shirt off. Very benevolent. And I would just be quiet. And let him talk first and see who showed up. And once I started figuring that out, it made my life so much easier, because it's like, okay, Prince number three is here. Coast is clear. We're giving us fun times in the city. Number two is here. You better have your A game or it's going to be trouble in the city.
That's so wonderful. Well, I want to thank you both so, so much for being here. This was such a wonderful conversation.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you so much for having us, man. And welcome to America.
Welcome to America. Welcome to America. That's Morris Hayes, co-producer on Prince's newly released album, Welcome to America, and Shelby J, one of Prince's longtime vocalists.
Let's check the record, see what it says. Seem like a good
That does it for us today on Press Play. Don't forget, you can download or subscribe to the Press Play podcast and listen whenever, wherever you want at kcrw.com/pressplay or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Michelle Aloy. I'll see you tomorrow.